Well, if you are just joining us, we are in a series walking through Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. And so basically what we're seeing is Jesus has a way for us to live in his kingdom that's different than the way that the world would want us to live. And so we're just digging in, going through verse by verse, walking through this passage. And I'm just going to be dead level honest with you. This morning and then next Sunday morning are 2 weeks that I would rather be gone. And so we're going to be talking about some challenging, difficult topics, but we're going to dig into those because we believe that Jesus has laid out for us a path that is wise. He knows better what's best for our lives than we do. And so we're going to dig in this morning and just jump right in. So start my sermon this morning by referencing two Old Testament characters whose names were Jacob and Esau. If you don't know much about Old Testament, you know, Jacob and Esau, they were brothers. Jacob was the original kind of quintessential mama's boy. He was favored by his mother. Esau was more of the man's man. He was a rugged kind of outdoorsman, a hunter type. And so one day Esau went off on this long hunt. And when he came back from the hunt, it says he was famished. He was starving. And so he came in and he saw that his brother Jacob had some stew. And he didn't really know what kind of stew. He just knew it was a red stew. And he saw that stew, smelled the stew, and he said, I would just love to have some of my brother's stew. And so Jacob said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll strike a deal with you, my brother Esau. If you will give me your birthright. Now, for us today, we think of birthright. What does that mean? Well, birthright was essentially your lifetime blessing. So your status is, in this case, Esau is the oldest child, would have received the birthright. He would have received the primary inheritance. His birthright stood for his blessing that he was going to have for the rest of his life. And he came in, and because he was in this famished, starving state, his brother Jacob said to him, Esau, if you will give me your birthright, I will give you some of this lentil stew. If you've ever had lentils, I assume that they taste the same way today that they did back then. They're not the most appealing thing. And so here's this guy who comes in, and you know he's probably fairly intelligent. And his brother offers him this deal for a few minutes of pleasure, for a few minutes of becoming satiated in his appetite. He's given the option to forfeit a lifetime of blessing. Now, we all know this, that Esau, in his right mind, would look at that offering that was laid out before him and say, Brother Jacob, go back to your mama. You're crazy. He would have said, there's no way in the world that I'm going to forfeit a lifetime of blessing, a blessing that my children can inherit. There's no way that I'm going to forfeit a lifetime of blessing for a few fleeting moments of pleasure. But if you know the story, Esau said yes to his brother Jacob, and he was able to consume the lentil stew and for a few moments have his appetite satisfied. But what he sacrificed was a lifetime of blessing. I want to just from the very beginning say to you this morning that that is the exact principle that I'm going to talk to you about this morning. If you'll open up with me to Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 27, Jesus in his winsome way is going to speak to us about an area of our lives where if we're not careful, we will sacrifice a lifetime of blessing for a few fleeting moments of pleasure. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 27, Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, and as we've seen before, this is Jesus' way of saying, this is what you have been told, this is what you have been taught, but Jesus comes not to lower God's standard, but to elevate it, to show that true righteousness that God longs for is not just outward activity and being obedient to the letter of the law, but actually there is a need to be obedient to the spirit of the law in our hearts. And so Jesus is contrasting what the religious people of his day would have heard when he says, you've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. And so this was an outward act. This was something that the religious people of his day, the scribes, the Pharisees, and others, could have looked at and said, I can check the box on that one. I've not committed adultery. I've not been with somebody who is not my spouse.
But verse 28, Jesus says, "But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Ouch. What Jesus does is he says, you've heard that God's heart is just on the superficial, check the box, I've not done the outward sin. But Jesus comes and says, let me meddle a little bit. If you've lusted after a woman, you've already committed adultery with her in your heart. Jesus moves from the outward activity to the inward reality. He goes on in verse 29. He says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off, throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. We're going to talk today about the struggle against and the fight for sexual purity and the fight against sexual sin. This is an area that, again, this week, next week, if it was up to me, I would say let's move on. But there is no area that is more relevant for our lives than this one. And so you may be here and you may say, well, that was part of my past. That's not something I struggle with any longer. If that's you, God bless you. But for the rest of us, we say we still battle with this. And I can assure you this, this is something that's affecting, if it doesn't affect you directly, it's affecting you indirectly directly through your children, through your grandchildren, through people that you rub shoulders with. It's something that is having a pervasive effect on our society as a whole. I read a story a few years ago about a professor from New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, very conservative evangelical seminary. And so as a professor there, he would have taught a very kind of conservative theology. His name was John Gibson. His wife came home one day. His wife's name was Christy. After her normal routine, around 5:30, she got to the house and she hollered for him and she noticed that he didn't respond and she sensed that something was off. Well, she went in, looked around the house, and what she found there is that her 56-year-old husband, the man who students in that campus had said he was one of the most gracious, caring professors that I've known. He invested in me. He always smiled at me. This woman came in to find that her husband had ended his life. And the reason that he had ended his life is because a few days prior to that, there was a hack on this website called Ashley Madison. Ashley Madison, the tagline for this website is this: life is short, have an affair. It was a website dedicated to helping people confidentially have affairs, but there was a data breach. Somebody had hacked it, made all that information public, and so this professor had said, I cannot go on with my life. He ended his life. Now, here's the thing. Do you think that when John Gibson gave his life to ministry, that he ever had a goal of one day in the future getting to this place that he was at? And that's the thing for all of us. We never think that we'll find ourselves in this position. I remember one time, my first full-time pastor at Warner, Oklahoma, going out visiting the nursing home. There was one individual there on a regular basis I would visit. His name was Freitas Ellis. This time he was 93 years old. And I came up to his room one day, and it was a fairly often occurrence where he would be standing beside his wife. Her name was Jiggs. She was unresponsive, couldn't communicate at all. But on this particular day, I came up beside and just heard him weeping. And just weeping, weeping, weeping. And he's a 93-year-old man. And I got over there to him and kind of not sure, should I awkwardly walk in or just kind of give him space? Well, eventually I made my way into the room and was able to talk with him and try to kind of find out what's going on, what's happening in his heart. And here's this 93-year-old man who's weeping beside his wife's bed because he said, a number of years ago, I made a terrible mistake. A number of years ago, 60 years ago, prior to that, he had gotten into an affair. He had gotten into a relationship with a woman other than Jiggs. And here it was, 60 years later, he was carrying the guilt and the shame of that. You know what that did for a young guy getting into ministry? It spoke a greater lesson than any book I could read on the topic of sexual purity, because it says to me that when we find ourselves in some kind of sin, sexual sin, the effects of that are things that the devil can use for years after that. And so it's the case that none of us have a goal of finding ourselves in a situation where we've gone too far. Nobody has a goal to get addicted to pornography, to spend hundreds of hours staring at a screen, to hurt your wife, to embarrass your kids, to lose your job. Nobody has a goal to inflict wounds into your children that will never fully leave them. Nobody has a goal of your spouse getting up in the morning, taking their daily antidepressants, driving to their weekly appointment with a psychologist, all to overcome the feelings of worthlessness that came when you cheated on them. Nobody has a goal, no father has a goal, of his kids getting into a vehicle after their game with another man. They call him dad. He takes them home. He runs them through the drive-thru. He experiences the craziness. He tucks them into bed while you sit home alone. We don't have a goal of any of these things ever happening, yet the reality is that they're happening every day. If they're not happening in your life, they're happening in the lives of people around you. So we just want to ask the question this morning, how do we fight against this? It's just my contention that this is not how Jesus wants his followers to live in the kingdom. And so if you find yourself already kind of feeling this awkward, oh no, he's going to put his finger on an issue, I believe that God's heart in this issue is for healing and for freedom. It's for us to break free from this bondage, to break free from the shame and the guilt that's associated with it. So let's charge right in and let's say, all right, what does Jesus have to say about us overcoming this area? So I want to talk to you about two specific areas where we need to fight for sexual purity. The first is that Jesus gives in verses 27 and 28, and it is, we fight for inward purity. Inward purity. Look again what Jesus says, verse 27. You've heard that it was said you should not commit adultery. So that's the outward form. But then Jesus goes right to the heart, verse 28. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So the first area, church, that we need to fight for purity is fight for inward purity. Now, I want to define here for just a minute what this word lust means, because already there are many of you men who are out there like, oh, yes. And, you know, women, you're kind of like, yeah, that's the thing that the guy struggles with, right? And so as a general rule, maybe there's a little bit of truth to that. But when we really define what lust is, I think that we see that it is a sweeping challenge, because lust is not just seeing something. Lust is savoring something. Lust is not just when you notice something with your eyes. Lust is when you consume something into your heart. Lust is when whatever it is that's out there, you allow to come in here. It's when this physical stimulus out there makes its way into your heart. And for men and women, this is going to be different. The way it plays out is a little bit different. And so you in general, I would say this, that men's lust is going to take them to a bedroom. So their thoughts are going to be more toward a bedroom, to a place where they can, you know, experience a more satisfying place in the bedroom. But for women, your lust is generally going to take you toward a beach. And so for men, we automatically are thinking about bedroom here. It's about the sexual pleasure. For women, it's going to be where you can experience a more satisfying companion, where you can have a greater heart connection. And so I don't want to say too much about romance novels and all those sorts of things, but it might be fitting to point that out, that lust for men and for women is different. And so for men, you're going to tend to picture or idealize a better, more satisfying lover. For women, you're going to tend to idealize a better, more satisfying companion. And so both men and women can apply what Jesus is saying here. It's not just noticing something out there, but it's actually letting that thing percolate and stir in your heart. The second thing to say about lust is this, that lust is a God-given desire used in a Satan-directed way. Lust is like fire. Fire can be really good if it's in the stove. Fire can warm a room. It can warm a home. It can bless everyone in it. But you let the fire out and it can burn the entire house down. There's nothing that's burning more houses down than this particular topic here. If you think about the effects that this is having, not just the direct effects, but indirectly, how our society would be different if we didn't struggle with this issue. We would have far fewer broken homes. We would have far fewer children who are growing up without knowing who their father is. Consequently, we would have far fewer children in the prison system. DHS, not Department of Homeland Security, but Department of Human Services, would have far less people to employ. Our whole culture would be different if this one issue, this fire, was contained. And so what Jesus does for us is he helps us to see that before you become pure in your actions, before you become impure in your actions, you become impure in your thoughts. And so there's typically a pattern that leads up to outward sin. The pattern starts with contemplation. Contemplation is when the little bird lands on your head. But then contemplation becomes rationalization, where you begin to contemplate what this would be like, and you rationalize in your mind and you say, well, other people are doing this, it can't be that bad. I'll be the one who escapes the consequences, or I deserve this, I should be able to do it. Contemplation leads to rationalization, and once you have rationalized the sin, brother, sister, you are capable of committing almost any sin because mentally you've convinced yourself that this is okay. And so Jesus moves straight to the heart. He references later Matthew 15:19. He says, out of the heart come evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, sexual immorality, thefts, false witness, slanders. If you think about the way affairs happen, affairs are almost always emotional before they are physical. We have to grasp that the line of sin is not the act. The line of sin is the thought. It's when contemplation begins to turn to rationalization. And what Jesus does for us here is he says, look, great if you don't commit adultery. Yes, good. But understand that God's heart is not just that the line of sin is the act. The line of sin is what's happening in the heart. It's the thought. And so that's the first area where we need to fight for sexual purity. The second is we need to fight for not only inward purity, but secondly, we fight for outward purity. And this is what Jesus gets at in verses 29 and 30. He essentially says, take the steps necessary to fight against this. When he says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out, throw it from you. For it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And by the way, some people, there's a lot of debate on exactly what Jesus is referring to when he's talking about hell. Is he talking about kind of this place in the future spoken of in Revelation? Or is he talking about this place of fire outside this garbage dump? And there's debate about that, but I will just say this safely. This is not a place that you want to go. You know, whatever your view, particularly that Jesus is talking about here, this is a place that you want to avoid. So Jesus leverages hell as a negative consequence that can occur. So in verse 30, he says, if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off, throw it from you, for it's better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. And so I want to spend some time talking about practically how we do that. So we first fight for inward purity, the heart. The line of sin is not just the act. The line of sin is what's taking place inwardly. And then secondly, we fight for outward purity. And the central truth is this, is don't sacrifice your soul for sex. Don't sacrifice a lifetime of blessing or an eternity of blessing for a few minutes of pleasure. And all of us, we know this logically in our right mind. We say, yes, there's no way. There's no way that I would want to do that. There's no way that I would want to see my children involved in that or my grandchildren involved in that. There's no way. Yet this is one of the chief areas where men and women are sacrificing a lifetime of blessing for a few moments of pleasure. And so I just ask you now, if you're here and you say, well, this is a struggle I've kind of moved past, or I've gotten a handle on, I want you to think about, as I talk about some practical ways to fight against this, think about your kids. Think about your grandkids. Think about ways that you can impart a wise path for them to walk. And so I want to share with you three ways that we can live this out, that we can practically fight. First of all, number one, for those of you who are married, I would just say invest in your own marriage. And let me say to the students, to those of you who are not here, you may think, well, yeah, once you're married, everything's fine, everything's good. If you've got sexual sin or sexual addiction now, if there's a hang-up now, marriage is not going to change that. Marriage may highlight a few concerns, may highlight some problems, but it's not going to change the fundamental struggle that you have. It's not an antidote to sexual struggles and sin. And so if you think about, if you are married, investing in your own marriage, Proverbs 5:15-20, the writer says, drink water from your own cistern, running water from your own well. Now notice the picturesque speech. Should your springs flow into the streets, should your streams of water into the public squares, let them be yours alone, never to be shared with strangers. May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. Glory, hallelujah, praise to God. God is not an anti-intimacy. He's not an anti-sex God. And for that reason, this shouldn't be an anti-taboo subject in the church. Listen to me. You want to know what people are saying about this outside the world? The average teenage boy today is exposed to pornography by the time he's 10 years old. So they're talking about it. They're showing it, everything else. And so if that's the case outside the world, I think we need to dig in and look at what God says about this, that God says, rejoice in this. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always. May you ever be captivated by her love. Why be captivated, my son, by an adulteress? Why embrace the bosom of another man's wife? There is a need for us. I'll just say this, and we will move on past this awkward point. But there is a need for us within the church to fight for passion, not passivity. The second thing is this, to practically fight for inward and outward purity. Number two, build a guardrail. Build a guardrail. 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee sexual immorality. Every other sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man sins against his own body. The battle against sexual sin is not just a spiritual battle. It is a spiritual and a physical battle, because it is the flesh that often wages war that we have to combat. And so if you're here and you say, well, I've asked God to heal me from this, I've asked God to deliver me from this, I've asked God to move this far away from me and take the temptation away, that's great if you ask God and you fight this battle spiritually, because it is a spiritual battle. But if you are neglecting the physical side of this battle, you're only fighting half the battle. Because this fight for sexual purity is a physical fight as well as it is spiritually. And so if you've ever seen the little jack-in-the-box thing, little thing, you crank, and then poof, you know, out it pops. You're not exactly sure when the little jack-in-the-box thing is going to pop out, but you're certain of this, that eventually it's going to happen. Here's the thing that we need to know when it comes to fighting against sexual sin. If we leave the opportunity out there, sooner or later, things are going to pop and we're going to give in. And so to eliminate the option, or to eliminate the temptation, we have to eliminate the option. Otherwise, it's just a matter of time, but boom, eventually we're going to become too tempted. Eventually we're going to give in. If the option is there, the temptation is there. And we are only designed to be able to withhold so much temptation. And eventually, if we leave the option available, the temptation is going to be available and it will defeat us. Now, I want you to think with me for just a moment. If suppose you were caught up in some kind of sexual issue, some kind of sin, whatever it might be, and you knew that in 5 minutes from now, the person that you wanted least to find out about this, like you didn't want anybody to ever know about it, but in 5 minutes, there is a party on their way to tell that individual. And you have 5 minutes to barter with God. Now, I know spiritually we're not supposed to make deals with God, right? We don't do that because, you know, God's going to kind of do his thing. But just say you've got 5 minutes to talk to God and explain to him, make deals with him, tell him, God, if you will just deliver me from this, if you will just make sure that this person doesn't find out whatever the thing is that you don't want known, you've got 5 minutes to talk to God and to convince him to change the other party that they won't go and say whatever it is that you don't want said. 5 minutes. What would you say? What would you promise God? What would you get down on your hands and knees and say, oh, God, please, in 5 minutes here, if you will just not let this happen, if you will just not let this person find out, if you will just not let the test show up positive, if you will just not, please, please, God, I will do anything. I will get rid of internet. I will throw away my computer. I will tell the woman I will never talk to her again in my life. I will do anything, God, if you will just please make sure that they don't find out. What would you do? What would you say? Because right now is your 5 minutes. Right now is your opportunity to, you know, whatever it is that you would want to avoid happening in the future, right now is your opportunity to draw a line and say, yeah, there's this issue, yeah, there's this problem, but I'm going to build a guardrail. And I'm going to say to the woman, I'm not going to talk to you ever again. I'm just going to admit that this temptation is there, this sense of this tendency to be drifting into sin. I'm going to admit that this is there, and I'm just going to say, this is my opportunity to avoid incredible pain and incredible regret later. I'll just be honest with you. My heart for you is you don't look back in 2 years or 5 years or 10 years and say, oh, I remember the guy was talking that one morning about what Jesus said about this area, and I knew right then in my heart that I needed to take action. I needed to build a guardrail, but I didn't do it. I thought that it wouldn't happen to me. I thought that somebody else, they're the ones who are going to suffer from this, not me. I wish that I had taken advantage of that opportunity, that window that God gave me then. See, some of you, you need to build guardrails. You need to take specific steps to distance yourself from whatever it is that leads you into sin. It may be making a phone call. It may be disconnecting from something. It may be installing software on your computer. I don't know what the thing is for you, but God does and you do. So build guardrails. The third step is this, is to call an ambulance. So if you've got good guardrails at the top, guess what? You're a lot less likely to move off the mountain and careen down the hillside and explode at the bottom. But for some of you, it's a little bit too late for the guardrails. For some of you, you've gone over the mountain and you're at a place where you're at the bottom of the hill and you feel as if things are hopeless right now. Like the entire time that I've been talking, you've been sitting there with this awkward sense of guilt and shame because, he's talking about an area that I know God is dealing with me, and I've tried to repress it, push it away, but here it is front and center. And he just won't let up. So I'll say to you this morning, what you need to do is, if the guardrail hasn't worked, call an ambulance. The practice, the James 5:16 that we talk about, we want to be a church where we are getting real with people. Let me tell you one of the most tragic and embarrassing things that we need to stand against in the church. It is this, that we are ashamed to admit temptation. How in the world did we ever get to a place in the church where we are ashamed to even admit that we are tempted? I mean, think about this for a moment. What that has done is it's not just kept us from confessing sin to other people. It's confessed us or it's kept us from even confessing the temptation to sin. So locked and bound are we in this culture of creating an image for others to project that makes them think that we're better than we really are. And this morning, for some of you, you've gone over the edge and you find yourself experiencing the damage of sexual dysfunction, sexual addiction, whatever it might be. You need to install some guardrails, but if you find yourself at the bottom of the mountain, struggling, wondering, is there a way out? Is there hope? I would say to you that in Jesus Christ, there absolutely is. You need to call an ambulance. You need to talk to another grace-filled, trustworthy believer and just share honestly what's going on in your life. Now, for me, it hits home. I've been on both sides of this battle. I've been on this side of the battle where I wake up in the morning and I think, oh God, why? Why have I done this? Why have I betrayed you? Why have I given in again? But I'll also tell you this, that I've been on the side of this battle where I've experienced freedom. And I've experienced the hand of God delivering. I've experienced the Spirit coming in. And through a little bit of humiliation on my part, through a little bit of becoming vulnerable and saying to grown men, hey, this is what's happened. This is what I've done. I'm not proud of this, but I've just got to come and say that I can't fight this battle on my own. I've got to have a battle buddy come in with me and help walk with me through this. Because if I try to fight this battle on my own, Satan has me dead to rights. And I tell you what I want to experience every day that God gives me on this earth is I want to be a dad who is a man of integrity. I want to be a dad who in our home, we break the generational cycles of sin. I want to be a dad in my home that can look at my kids and say, all right, kids, I want to lead you in this path toward purity, because this world is going to lead you toward impurity. This world is going to lead you to a place where I heard a story just this morning. There's one pastor in particular who's calling upon young women to turn their virginity rings in, their purity rings in, to melt them into an idol, I believe, to Satan. There is a world that is pushing against the very fabric of our purity. And so that's just what I want from my heart. But I know this. That does not come because I just simply say, okay, God, will you take care of this issue for me? Okay, it's gone. That there have to be practical steps taken. I have to build guardrails. And at times we have to be willing to call an ambulance. We have to be willing to say, I have fallen. I'm not proud of it, but I have. And so I'm asking you to come help me up. Help me journey back up onto the mountaintop. That, I believe, is what God's heart and desire is for you. Here's the incredible thing about this. If you're at a place where you feel stuck, like you feel like there's the bondage of sin is wrapped around you, you're not sure how it is you're going to get out, and you will be intentional to obey the laws Jesus lives so you can experience the life that Jesus offers, if you give yourself to the words of Jesus and begin to build guardrails, you'll begin to call an ambulance. What you will experience is a freedom that you have longed to experience for years and years and years. What you'll find is that sense of shame and that sense of guilt that locks you into this prison is broken open through the power of confession. Healing is God's agenda for you. If you hear the voice of condemnation, even as I speak, what you need to know that the voice of condemnation is not God. That is your enemy, the devil. He would want to keep you locked into condemnation. And the Spirit of Jesus, however, would want to bring to you life, freedom, wholeness, and hope in Him. And so as we think about relational goals, as we study the life of Jesus, if this is an area right now where you feel trapped, you feel stuck, I get you're not going to want to stand up and say, hey, me too. You know, I've got this issue right now. But if this is an issue that you really struggle with, I would just encourage you sometime through the course of the week, give me a call. Give one of our elders a call. Give some trustworthy, grace-filled believer you know. Just give them a call and say, look, I need to call an ambulance. Just start out with that. So we've already broached the subject. I just need to call an ambulance, and I need some help in this area. And my heart for you is that you would have freedom. You would walk in wholeness. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for Jesus. I thank you, as we sang earlier, great is your faithfulness, Lord, unto me. And I pray this day that your people, your children here at Grace Chapel, that we would experience your faithfulness. That those who have believed this lie, that they've lived with this for 30 or 40 years and they've kept it tucked away, I pray that they would know that for the remaining years of their life, you have a better, different path for them to follow. And I pray for the kind of church here where people are not drawn in and compelled because of some kind of production or some kind of show that we present on a Sunday morning, but they're drawn in because there is the life of Jesus residing in these people. That we are embodying the work of Jesus in us, and we are imperfect vessels. We are jars of clay that are being broken and made into the image of Jesus. And so I pray this morning in this particular area, oh, for freedom. For release from the shame, for release from the guilt. I pray this in the great name of Jesus. Amen.